City, yet another edition, and edition number 30. We're up to 30 of these. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you. Rob, how is everything in New York?
So far, so good. It was a fairly decent week weather-wise. My company went through an office move, which is about the move itself. The physical move is over, but it's going to take several weeks until everything is in its place. We still need cabinetry and the lights to be finished, but we've moved into a really nice new office, albeit only a block and a half from where we were. So it's good. You know, things are definitely moving in a very positive direction there. And my big announcement of the week is starting next Saturday, I begin recording again for the first time in a very, very long time.
Attaboy.
I'm not going to announce a definitive date, but I will have a single coming out. Possibly
Excellent.
By year's end, or at least at the beginning of the new year. So, we'll keep you all apprised of that sooner than later.
Very good. We'll have to find out which one of the dosers is going to review it.
Well, see, if I did it, it's a dick move.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of like if you go out on stage wearing your own band's T-shirt.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you just don't.
That's a no-no. Unless you're in that petrol emotion, you never wear your own T-shirt.
And we've got a whole bunch going on. While we're having this conversation, most of my family is now having massive storms overhead and all of this, so we're watching closely. Even though we're here in the middle of the country, they're all in the Tampa Bay area. So crossed fingers and hoping for the best for everybody there. But, man, it was interesting to watch the coverage. And, again, I mean, the irony is not lost on me. Every time we see these guys out in the middle of all of this shitstorm, and they're saying, don't anybody go outside. And I'm thinking, you're breaking your own rule, schmuck. it's the same story over and over again.
Well, first and foremost, and most importantly, are your family members that are down there in safe quarters?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're even though they're in the Bay Area, they're far enough inland and they're far enough up. Dad's elevation at his house is something like 85 feet. So, yeah, if his house goes under, there's bigger problems than just that.
Okay, that's
thank you.
Good news, number one. Number two, I'm glad to see that the governor – took the initiative with more than ample time and proof in hand to make sure that people followed a mandatory evacuation.
Yeah.
I think in a very odd way, Rick Scott may have saved his own job because, of course, most people in Florida really can't stand him. But I thought he did a really magnificent job with the way he handled it. I think most people were wise enough to heed that call. I'm glad to see that most of the areas that are to be affected have been cleared out. My own cousin wisely decided to leave her home in Boca and flew up to Nashville.
Yeah.
Just in time. She gave me fair warning and said, we decided to get out of town. And I thought, okay, good. Just let me know when you've arrived in Nashville and are safe. So, that's all very, very positive. Watching the news at times is a daunting prospect because, you're putting somebody out there standing in the middle of the storm in peril.
Yeah.
As you just stated, the whole thing about you're breaking your own rules, schmuck. And, of course, there's always that one moment when you're watching, and this is the peril and also comedy of live broadcasts. Last night, I'm sure most people who were watching CNN caught the unsuspecting reporter have this fellow just come running around behind him screaming, fuck her right in the pussy,
right,
on live TV. And I'm sorry, that equates – a loop, that you just want to run over and over and over again for the sheer audacity and hilarity of it.
Here's the thing, though, and this is what bothers me about it, is that there will come a time, and it may not happen. I mean, it may not happen for the next 50 years. You and I may be a distant memory by the time it happens. But if they keep pulling this stunt and having not just one guy anymore, now it's, well, we've got this guy in Naples, and we've got this guy in Tampa, and we've got this guy in West Palm. And, I mean, covering the story from every angle. And I understand that's what they want to do, but it's only a matter of time before one of those guys drowns. Somebody's going to get
hit by some flying debris. You're absolutely right.
Exactly.
Because this morning, one of the CNN reporters was standing there, and she's trying to talk. The winds are whipping. This was in Miami Beach.
Yeah.
And as the winds are whipping, all of a sudden you hear a loud bang, and literally maybe 5 to 10 feet away from her, a metal street sign just went boom right over.
Right.
So this is, You're absolutely correct. There's going to be a tragedy sooner than later.
Yeah, and another one today, while the eyewall was making its way into Naples, and they had two guys, one of them was Cuomo, and the other one, I can't remember, Ed Lavandera. And Ed Lavandera was doing a report from on the street, and this will show you how powerful these storms are, because behind him, about 30 feet away, as they cut to him in the shot, a palm tree, a full-size 30-foot palm tree, went over and hit the ground. I mean, just the thing fell down and he didn't even notice. I mean, that's how loud that cacophony is. But you figure if he had picked a different location, that thing could have fallen right on him.
You know, we're talking a moment ago about having somebody on live TV come up and say something that is considered verboten. And I forgot to bring up something interesting that was on a network show a couple of weeks ago. We've talked about that show Preacher that's on AMC.
Yep.
Which is very entertaining. It's really good. It's coming to the end of the second season. For those who don't know, it's a show that was actually brought to AMC by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. And there is a character who right now is going through this mental breakdown in which he's trapped in his own mind and thinks he's in hell. And the people that he's locked in hell with are, you know, the obvious awful people that have done the most horrific things. And his mentor down there happens to be Hitler.
Of course.
And there's this one scene, and I'm bringing this up for a reason. There's one scene in which Hitler, who's actually the nicest of all of these people.
Which is a very Seth Rogen thing to do, by the way. That's hilarious.
Of course. Interestingly enough, by the way, Hitler is played by Noah Taylor, who, of course, played Dick in Almost Famous. But this is the second time that he's played Hitler.
Yeah. Because
he played Hitler in that movie Max and Me with Cusack.
Right.
So as Hitler, he's asking for everybody to be quiet. And then he screams, "Will you be quiet?" And somebody says, "Why should we be quiet?" And he goes, "Because I'm Adolf fucking Hitler." And they didn't bleep the word fucking.
Really?
This show airs at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering, have I missed something somewhere? Could this have possibly been the first time somebody has gotten away with using the word fucking on the air on a, you know, quote, prime time show?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, the FCC has no say over cable, none. So as long as it airs on a network like AMC, the only thing they have to worry about is losing sponsors. That's it. They could have guys at 3 o'clock in the afternoon talking about, well, like you said, fuck it right in the pussy. They, you know, the thing the guy said on the news, that could go out on purpose on AMC at 3 p.m. Wouldn't make any difference, except they would never get any advertisers. It's the only reason they don't do it. So the funny thing is that sometimes censors are supposed to find that stuff and they miss it. And I can think of two prime examples, because when I was a kid, I was like 11 or 12 and I came home from school and I was watching this movie on TV called How Do I Love Thee? And Jackie Gleason was in it, and it's a long story, but there's a scene in this movie where the young couple has sex and they didn't cut it out. And I mean, there was nudity right there. And this was a broadcast station. This was Channel 44 in Tampa. And I thought, this is the best thing I've ever seen on television. And the other one was about, and this was also on broadcast TV, and it wasn't that long ago, maybe 10 years ago. They played, speaking of John Cusack, they played the movie Gross Point Blank. And I had to eventually ask Dan Aykroyd about this in an interview, and my suspicion was confirmed. The way they go through those movies and do the censorship when they put them on TV is by the script. The problem with that is, if somebody says fuck and it's not in the script, it doesn't get cut out. So that whole scene where he's in one part of the house and Cusack's in the other part and they're trying to kill each other and he's saying, "I'm going to blow your fucking head off," that wasn't in the script. So it went out on broadcast television, and that was network. It was great.
Interesting. I'm curious about these things because it's unexpected.
Right.
You know? I mean, of course, it's like watching South Park and every time they get to the word fuck, then they bleep it out.
Right.
Every other word under the sun is permissible.
Yep. Yeah, and it doesn't, I mean, Comedy Central could let it go. They choose not to. And there are times, by the way, on Comedy Central where late at night, and it's usually safe harbor hours after 10 p.m., they'll play a comedy special like Eddie Murphy Raw, and they'll let it go uncensored and unedited.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching Bill Burr one night, and Bill, as we all know, Bill Burr lets loose very easily. Right. So, you know, he was machine gunning somebody, and then, you know, the four letter expletives were coming out one after the other. So I was wondering if that was something that was a fact, or, you know, what was the first, because I do not recall ever hearing, again, in prime time on a, you know, quote, network show, even though AMC is cable, the word fuck used.
Yeah, the only time there's a name for it, and I can't remember what the FCC calls it, but the only ones that they have any control over are the over-the-air broadcasts, both on radio and TV. So Sirius, that's how Sirius Satellite gets away with it, because it's technically not an over-the-air broadcast. You have to pay for it. But there's a, it's a fleeting something or other. It's a, you know, a fleeting utterance or something like that. So if during a football game, the parabolic mic happens to catch somebody go, what the fuck? And I've heard that happen a few times, by the way. That's okay. They're not going to fine anybody for that.
We've had that happen a couple of times on SNY during Met games. Gary, Keith, and Ron are very good at, you know, as they're laughing, they're trying to tempt the whole thing, because they're like, and for you kids who've been watching, don't repeat what you just heard.
Yes. Like that. Exactly, yeah.
And then they go back to talking about things like the Ramones.
You got Mr. Met flipping people off. So, you know, it's a little bit of a different atmosphere at Met games.
Not that I can blame him.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. Now, we do have a few things to go over before we even get into the meat of our webcast today, because we have a couple of just major names in entertainment who we lost over the last couple of days. And one of them was, and I found this out by reading his Facebook feed, was a friend of a friend of mine. I have a buddy who, long before he got into talk radio, was a country music DJ. And so let's go over that and lay it out for us. Who is it that we lost this week?
To me, one of the greatest country singers of any generation, Don Williams, the Gentle Giant, passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was a child, and WHN switched to a country format, my mother, for some inexplicable reason, and I'm grateful to her for having done it, stuck with it. That was her favorite pop station, and she stayed with the country format. So when I was small, you know, when I was about 10 or 11 or whatever, we were listening to country a lot, especially in the car, and it was Don Williams who really kind of reeled me in with his voice and with the songs. I mean, he had hits. He had several hits like We Should Be Together, You're My Best Friend, I Recall a Gypsy Woman. You know, those songs put him on the map. I Wouldn't Want to Live If You Didn't Love Me was a big one.
And to be waiting when I get home with love and just for me. No, I wouldn't want to live if you didn't love me.
And I Believe in You, I think, was his last giant hit. But there was one song in particular that to this day, and of course this is locked in my memory from childhood, of course, but it was such a beautiful and overwhelmingly powerful song that every time I hear it, even now, I have to fight back the tears. And it's a song called Till the Rivers All Run Dry. And it is just
a piece of music.
It's so beautiful, and so it's flawless. And his voice, it's beyond touching. And that's what always made him my personal favorite. So this is a grand loss to me. You know, yes, he was 78 years old and he wasn't in the greatest health, but still, when it's another part of your childhood that goes, you know, it's a little hard to digest. And it's doubly jarring for me, because just a few months ago, within the last year, I managed to finally pick up the albums that I had as a kid on vinyl on CD, because they're so hard to find. MCA did not do him justice by reissuing his old ABC Dot albums. So to find them on import was a very happy accident. And it's a loss. It's a loss.
No doubt about it, but not the only loss this week either.
No. The other one is, for those of you who are into the pantheons of more obscure experimental rock, especially that of krautrock, You're going to know the name Holjazuke, who was the bass maestro and sound loops genius, if you will, and visionary of the band Can, and he passed away as well. You know, he was in his 80s, and he's now the third member of Can to leave us. But nevertheless, Holjazuke was one of those bass players that it's, I think it's a pretty safe statement to say, if you ever heard his bass playing, especially if it was separated out in a channel away from the rest of the band, was so extraordinarily inventive, it would make you want to pick up bass. And if you never played bass or a guitar player, you'd want to switch to bass because he was in a universe all of his own. You know, and he was very good about not just the bass style, but like I was saying about electronic loops. He had, I think Brian Eno stole his thing, frankly, because he was the first to do it, you know, to use the whole, the, it was really the precursor to sampling. But Holjazuke was doing it first on the old Can albums back in the 60s.
Right. Well, and that's always been the thing. I mean, if you want to know where music's going next, or at least if you did from the early 60s all the way through to the late 80s, you watched what a lot of the German experimental guys were doing, because the I hate to dive right into a stereotype, but the precision and the experimentation just worked so well together that, well, I mean, Kraftwerk, you know?
Right, and the thing is, Holjazuke actually was a student and collaborator with Stockhausen before he actually joined a rock band.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, he came from that very deeply intellectual musical world to join up with the musical ruffians, if you will. But he was a genius. He was a visionary. Without him, there was no Can. It's that simple. You want to hear him at his best? It's 14 minutes, and it's 14 minutes of sheer heaven. Mother Sky. That to me was always the ultimate contract. But yeah, we lost two giants this week.
You know, I'm glad that you went into a little bit of the history on that, because it reminded me of something that we were lucky enough to go and witness last night. My wife and I got a call on Friday afternoon, and it was from a friend of mine who runs a theater in a little town called Edwardsville, Illinois. And he called up and he said, hey, do you want to go see Jesse Colin Young Friday or Saturday? And I thought, wow, the Youngbloods, huh? Okay, sure. Yeah, why not? Let's see what Jesse Colin Young is like now that he's probably in his mid-70s. And two things. First, his voice is amazing. He puts on a hell of a show, and it was great to see him sort of in his element. And they split the show up, so he did the first half solo acoustic, and then the second half of the show brought out his band. And his band is something that, to give a little bit of the history of this, his son is a bass player and plays a 6-string bass. And I want to tell you, the fretboard on that thing is about a mile tall. But it's great to watch him. And he's one of those guys who's very understated, just stands at the back and holds down the rhythm. And he does it brilliantly. But his son went to Berklee School of Music, and just graduated from there. And Jesse told the story during the concert. He said, well, what happened was, I went to see my son's senior recital, and I was looking at all of these kids who are all 22 and 23 years old and are these amazing musicians. And he said, I had made the decision 5 years ago to retire from playing music live. And then I saw these kids and I got excited again. So he had his son pick the best musicians, the best keyboard player, the best guitar player, himself, a couple of singers from Berklee, and put this band together of a bunch of kids and took them out on the road. They're fantastic.
That's a great way to earn your stripes.
Yeah.
And to refine and hone your chops.
Right.
Which I think that's a really, really good, that's a great thing to hear.
It was a cool deal. And I want to tell you, I mean, they are among the best players that I've heard at each position. You know, he put together this dream band of position players, and it just took off. So good for him. And if you get the chance, while you still can, go see Jesse Colin Young.
Was this after dinner at Auntie Chava's on Friday?
Yeah.
Shabbos dinner. Shabbos Mexican, right?
That's right.
You know, it's funny. You're talking about seeing Jesse Colin Young with this band of kids play this fantastic set at a small club in the Midwest, whereas the general consensus coming in from the two shows that Eric Clapton just did at Madison Square Garden, he really should just not do this anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, I would say that a good portion of the reviews were trying to be kind would be the best way to phrase it.
Mm-hmm.
High praise for his opening acts, who turned out to be Gary Clark Jr., who is just beyond description and so amazing to watch and listen to, and Jimmy Ray Vaughan, you know. But apparently Slowhand is incredibly slow-handed. He can barely play.
Ugh.
And it may give greater credence to that story we had heard last year about him having some kind of debilitating degenerative disease that makes it impossible for him to play guitar. If that's the case, apart from the fact that why would you be foolish enough to go out and put your health at greater risk by touring and trying to play for 2 hours when you really can't anymore?
Uh-huh.
Why are you ripping off your fans like this?
Right.
That's a really, really disturbing thought.
And it's not even just ripping them off of their money. And I'm sure that the tickets at Madison Square Garden went for quite a princely sum. But it's also ripping them off of the memory of what you were able to do in your heyday. You don't do that.
At the time invested, you know, people coming to see you.
Right, right.
You know, making the effort.
Yeah, yeah, that's too bad. And really, you know, I think that whatever that debilitating illness is, aside from Keith Richards, there is a limit to the amount of smack you can do in your life that when you get to your 70s won't turn you into somebody who can barely move.
Let's remember something about Keith Richards, though. When he was 40, he looked like he was 70.
Right, right.
And now that he's 72, he looks like he's 69. He's been buttoning it, you know. He's regenerated.
Yeah, he's the Dorian Gray of the Rolling Stones. So
that meme we keep seeing, you know, we've got to start preparing this world for how we're going to leave it for Keith Richards.
Yeah, right. And it's so completely true. Now, that said, you brought us to Madison Square Garden. Let's stick around your hometown of New York for a little while, because we've been doing the ongoing saga of the mayor of New York and how it hasn't been going terribly well. Here's how weird this is. We talked nice about Rick Scott, and now we're going to blast Bill de Blasio again. What's going on now?
I mean, the thing is, he's running for mayor, and you know, we've seen all of two debates between him and Sal Albanese, who's the only Democratic opponent. And as nice of a guy as Sal Albanese is, unfortunately, he hasn't got a chance in hell of beating de Blasio. But de Blasio is just so unbelievably the arrogant. He is no different than Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is Donald Trump is Donald Trump. Say what you will. Donald Trump, in all the years that you and I have seen him and had to endure him, he's never changed.
Nope, he's never been any different.
The one thing you can say about Trump is you can set your clock by him. He is who he is the way he is. He's not going to fail you. De Blasio is definitely one of those snake oil salesmen.
Right.
You know, he comes off as being nice and righteous and look at me, but he is definitely butt-fucking this city. And it's really, really getting to that point of, will somebody please stand up and say, hang on a second. I mean, he is so it's hard for me to put it into coherent sentences because I watch and I get really riled up. But, you know, he in these – like I've told you before, in these town hall meetings and during the debates, he doesn't let the opponent finish speaking. You know, he barks over him with that condescending, I'm smarter than everybody in the room kind of vibe. There's one reporter in all of New York who has the ability to not blink an eye when a question has to be asked and he starts attacking, because you can't criticize him.
Yeah.
In the least. Marsha Kramer of CBS News is his biggest opponent. She will go right after him and has done so almost from the get-go because he's lied to everybody so many times. And, you know, he was doing that thing about getting a commission in to reevaluate the statues that may be harmful to people in New York. First of all, inanimate objects are not harmful unless they're teetering precariously off balance and are going to fall on your head.
Right.
I'm sorry. If you're that much of a pussy, then you might do us all a favor and just blow your fucking brains out and get off the planet.
Right, or just move somewhere. Do what the rest of them do. Move out in the middle of meth country and buy a fucking farm and we'll never have to hear your voice again.
Right, build a bunker and hide underground, whatever, but just fuck off already.
Yep.
But this whole dog and pony show about getting a commission together, you know, amongst the commission, Harry Belafonte. Who the fuck wants to hear from Harry Belafonte? The only thing I want to hear out of him is Deo. Look a boo-boo.
Yep.
That's it. Otherwise, Harry, shut up.
Yeah.
Because nobody to be talking, especially in this day and age. And I notice it's always these dogs who have a lot of cash that like to bark the loudest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, de Blasio trying to come off like, oh, I don't know, somebody that you and I know from Vermont, you know, that snake oil salesman.
I don't know what you're saying. I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, they like to pretend they're man of the people, but they've got these great big caches of money hidden away.
And
the thing is, de Blasio is just so arrogant about it all. Hey, whatever happened with the Central Park carriage horses? Oh, I know. They're still there.
Yeah. Right. So, well, and the thing is, you'd think they would get it after a while. You'd think that they would at least watch somebody else who was successful at doing what they want to do and go, maybe I'll try and be like that guy. Because you talk about the fact that, you know, here he is and he's always shutting you down by trying to convince you he's the smartest guy in the room. Wrong. I mean, do what Pacino said in The Devil's Advocate. Never let him see you coming. Never let him see you coming. The reason why Bill Clinton was so successful at what he did, Monica Lewinsky aside, is because he let everybody call him Bubba, and he let them fucking believe it. And then you start hearing him talk, and you go, holy shit, this guy's brilliant. And well, you never let him see you coming.
The thing is with the real Bill, not this Bill, is the fact that he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Right.
This jerk off isn't. He's a fucking N-word. First of all, Bill de Blasio isn't even his name. So where do we begin with this nonsense,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The fact that we have reached a point in this city, and this is not an exaggeration, but this is the voice of someone who's lived here his whole life and sees it happening yet again. There are more homeless and, more importantly, more degenerates out on our local streets than there have been since the days of Giuliani and Bloomberg.
Yep.
All of a sudden, we've reverted back to the Dinkins era. You know, you've got the homeless, you've got the bums begging and looking for money, you've got the junkies and the skells mooching for money if they're not going to try and mug you. So now you've got to be twice as vigilant.
Yeah.
You've got that problem. You've got businesses going out of business left, right, and center because they can't afford the rent. But he's certainly letting it be okay for the rent to be jacked up. And I don't really need to go through my weekly spiel about the MTA and the problems that have arisen to a heightened degree under his mayorship.
Well, right, and we're going through something kind of similar here because on the Missouri side of the river in St. Louis, there was the same guy who was mayor for 16 years. And, you know, he wasn't universally loved, but he wasn't universally hated. Everybody kind of was okay with him. And he just resigned. He didn't resign. He just decided not to run again last time around. And so this woman, Lida Crewson, came in. And by the way, the city of St. Louis is about 300,000 people just in the city alone. And there will never be another Republican mayor of St. Louis. It will not happen. So really, the Democratic primary is the election. And as soon as Lida Crewson won, and she was challenged, but as soon as she won the Democratic primary, it was a foregone conclusion. So she's been mayor now for a year, and she's not hated, but what's happening to her right now is that she's discovering, and she's been in government for a while, but she's discovering that when your name is on the door, you take all of the shit. And the problem that was, you know, that blew up in Ferguson after the Michael Brown shooting, and the perception that the police throughout the city are nothing but a racist goon squad. And even though, I mean, are those guys out there? Yeah, I think they probably are. Is it all of them? No. But that perception has a good portion of that 300,000 people feeling like they're under the gun all the time. And she's been doing the same kind of town hall meetings and just been getting excoriated because she's still fairly new to the job, but she hasn't shown anybody that she knows what to do about it. And nobody else knew how to fix the problem either, but right now she's just getting blasted for it. And I'm interested to see if she decides to put on her big girl pants and actually try to do something.
Well, the thing is, de Blasio has, in fact, done a very good job all by himself to foster the idea that he is anti-police and pro the criminal element.
Right.
That it's okay to hate the cops. It's okay to accuse every police officer of being racist. And, you know, it said a lot to me that – because I am very pro-police. Without the police, we've got nothing.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. You know, we have chaos. They're there doing a difficult and life-threatening job. And if people can't see that just from that angle alone, there's a bigger problem within the framework of society. But, you know, for him to have so many police officers turn their collective backs on him when he decided to attend the funeral of the two police officers who were executed while they were sitting in their squad car.
Yeah, right.
You know, that spoke volumes to me. And then for him to do, of course, what he did heading off to Germany after a police officer was murdered, it's unpardonable.
Right.
It is absolutely – people of New York need to look at these things. These are acts that have been committed by the mayor thumbing his nose at the police and essentially the citizens of this city.
Right.
What more do you need?
Yeah, and how many times when we were growing up were we told people are individuals and they're individually responsible for their actions? Okay, can we just do that and hold people individually responsible for their actions without these universal condemnations and all the horseshit?
No. When you've got somebody like Bill de Blasio who sits there at the table and has somebody like Al Sharpton as one of his, not advisors, but one of the people he will give his airtime too, you know, it tells me where this guy is going and where his head is at.
Yeah,
so he's another one with that whole socialist pie in the sky thing. And guess what? This isn't a city of communists.
Right. Well, and wherever his head is, I'm guessing it doesn't smell terribly good.
I would say you were quite correct.
Oh, too much. Now, we've got some new music to get into and some other things that are going on in the world to hang on the door here as well, because I can't wait, by the way, to get to our In Our Head segment, because we're going to have a lot of fun with that this go-around. But we've also been going over album by album a couple of our favorites over these last few episodes of the show. And last week, we brought in movies as well. And we're going to do both of those things this time around, because we just got done at the theater seeing Stephen King's It. And not to do any spoilers here about the movie itself, but I guess by the time you're hearing this, if you really wanted to see it, you probably already have, is that it tells half of the story that's in the book. And it was by design. I'm not trashing the movie. They wanted to tell that part of the story. And so they did. And they did it really effectively. And it's funny because the reviewer on my show is also my producer. And he said that the movie probably wouldn't age terribly well because of the amount of CGI. Now, I hate CGI with a burning passion, but in this movie, it didn't bother me. So there have been a few movies out lately that I thought, I can't lose myself in this. I can't suspend disbelief because of this crap CGI. So whatever there was in this movie, it didn't bother me that much. But it was also very effective at telling its story. I mean, I found myself emotionally invested a couple of times to the point where I was making a face at the movie. Like, when I was supposed to be angry, I was making an angry face. I mean, you got to be good to do that. And, you know, Stephen King movies have run very hot and cold. I can't think of any Stephen King adaptation, whether he was involved in it or not, that I'm lukewarm on. They're either amazing or they suck. So I know you're a fan of you don't read the books so much, but you like watching the Stephen King movies.
That's very true. And of course, one of the movies that I will just very often quote from just at random, because it, of course, with my twisted sense of humor, makes me laugh to no end, is Carrie.
Of course. Yeah. And The Shining too.
Carrie's and The Shining, you know, I mean, who doesn't somewhere along the lines do the whole, you know, here's Johnny, or more importantly, like, Wendy, my head hurts.
I'm not going to hurt you.
Yeah, I'm just going to bash your fucking brains in.
Right.
Of course, old work and no play makes Rob a dull boy.
Uh-huh, indeed. But,
you know, those movies, it is an interesting thing because, first of all, they were done in the era when, if you were going to create effects, especially for something that, with the way that Stephen King writes, is incredibly visual.
Yep.
Which is what makes him such a great writer, is they had to come up with ways to make this work, you know, in a screen adaptation. I think Carrie really takes it to an absolute masterful apex. You know, I mean, yeah. From the scene where, you know, she's covered in the pig's blood to where she flips the car over, to the scene where she sends the knives hurling across the air into her mother's back.
That's amazing, right?
But it's also the manner in which, A, the scripts for those particular movies were written and the performances delivered. I mean, Piper Laurie truly deserved an Oscar.
Yep.
For that role. I'm sorry, because those lines are the most unforgettable, creepy, and hysterical at the same line. I think I equate the character of Margaret White with that of Patrick Bateman. You know, it's either going to be...
Very much, you know, so, yeah.
I was weak and backsliding, and I liked it. Versus, do you like Huey Lewis in the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Is that a raincoat? Yes, it is, Alan. Come on. But the beauty of Stephen King movies is, like I said, he's a visual writer. So you want to see these before your eyes. You want to see what you've imagined to see if it meshes.
Right.
And then, of course, there's always the problem of what you have in your mind is going to be sorely disappointed by what comes on the screen. I mean, Stephen King hates the movie version or the Jack Nicholson movie version of The Shining.
Yeah.
He denounced that. But another great one that people tend to forget or oversee, The Dead Zone, was terrific.
Oh, it was. That was a fantastic movie. And with Christopher Walken, how can you go wrong? But still, he was so much more understated in that movie than you normally see him.
Whoa, peanuts in a bag. Wow. Frankenstein never scared me.
Your dog has no tail. Oh, man. But no, I agree. And I mean, even Christine, which most of the Stephen King lovers can't stand. I love that movie. And I'm willing, I think a lot of the problems that people had with it are that it isn't particularly bloody, although it is. They do go, I wouldn't say they go overboard with it, but there's a lot of goo in that movie. And I'm fine with that, too. But with Christine, I'm willing to forgive the machinations that they have to undergo to take a 600-page book and adapt it to 90 minutes on the screen. I understand you've got to jam some shit into the plot that doesn't quite make sense, especially because it's so wrong with the book, but you have to. Otherwise, you can't tell the story or the movie's going to turn into a miniseries. So I just thought it was fun. And not to mention, I could watch that car roll across the screen and run over Moochie 100 times.
At the end of the day, if you're entertained and you got your money's worth, that's really all that matters. Look, there are movies that, getting away from Stephen King, that you and I have seen, that you and I love, that the critics, of course, reviled at, we could watch them over and over again, and we can quote from them.
Yep.
You know, because, of course, knowing you and I, you can quote from it, I can quote from it, and we'll know what the other one's quoting from. But I mean, movies like Revenge of the Nerds or Bachelor Party, you know, the kind of goofy films that we would see during the summer of 84, you get your money's worth, you get your laugh, and you also watch it whenever it's on cable 30 years later.
Right, right.
You know, the thing about with the Stephen King movies, you tend to go back and you watch those classics. Every time The Shining is on, you're waiting for that moment with, you know, the elevator opens up and out comes the blood, you know. And you wait for that moment with of course, you know, him going through the maze with the axe.
Right.
You know, you're waiting for that climactic ending when he flips out, you know, and you're waiting for Carrie with the prom scene.
With Bachelor Party, the one I always wait for is, I'm trying to kill myself. With an electric razor? Well, at least your wrist will be smooth and kissable.
Oh, my favorite that I always wait for is, what's up, bro? Bring them back, otherwise I call Milt. This is Milt.
I just bet my balls and shook on it. What a brilliant film that was.
It is. I mean, just think, that was little Tom Hanks.
Yeah, yeah, right after his brilliant on TV success with Peter Scolari, exactly.
And Donna Dixon and the late Wendy Jo Sperber.
Right, yeah, comedic genius, absolutely. Now, away from the movies for just a second and back into the music talk, because we've got a couple of things to go over here. And as we said, the album... album by album look that we've taken at a couple of these things has really gotten me excited. And you picked one this week that is another favorite. And I don't know. I mean, if you listen to this album back to front, number one, you won't find a weak track on it. And number two, if you don't love it, I'm firmly convinced there's something seriously wrong with you.
oh, if you don't love this album, you're an asshole.
I mean, but that's what it is. You're right.
look, we'll call a spade on this, because this is one of those that, you know, I often joke and say what a life changer this was. This album is the pivotal album that changed my life. It's second only to Revolver, and only because Revolver, you know, was when I was a child. The thing is when you listen to this album back to front, it's the Revolver of the modern era. And who I'll be talking about momentarily was striving for that. You know, especially if you ask him now, he will say, well, yeah, we've been listening to Revolver a lot right before we started recording. I didn't expect anybody not to notice.
Right.
But the thing is, Revolver is this album's core inspiration. And the album that I'm talking about, the album that truly changed my life completely, and I do mean completely, is Sound Effects by The Jam, which came out in 1980. This is the album that had Start as its leadoff single.
Yep.
The Jam's second number one single. It had That's Entertainment, which is still lauded as Paul Weller's finest moment as a songwriter. I will take exception with that, because he's written some tracks that I would say most people would think of as toss-offs that are far and away streets and miles ahead of That's Entertainment, but I don't want to digress. This album is The Jam breaking away from what I consider the traditional Jam sound. If you listen to the first four albums, because this was their fifth album at that point, it doesn't sound like the typical cacophony that you would definitely find that ran from All Mod Cons into Setting Suns. This is The Jam kind of paring it back a bit, yet expanding the sound. A greater use of an acoustic guitar as an underlying instrument mixed in. You know, you'll find little nuances like a rhythm box, mm-hmm. you know, and give a pulse to some of the tracks. Them attempting a sort of deconstructed funk feel on a track like Scrape Away. Also, Weller's most, I personally feel, his finest collection of lyrics as the main songwriter of The Jam. I think that was his absolute apex, because all the songs run different gamuts of emotions. They run from the personal / romantic on a song like Monday.
Yeah, right.
Oh, baby, I'm dreaming of Monday.
Monday, which is just such an unbelievably gorgeous song.
Yes, and that's what I was going to add to this, is that in my mind, I mean, it was Paul Weller not being afraid to be pretty. And that, I think, was a big step forward.
Because if you notice, Monday isn't an acoustic ballad. It's got the band's chops in it.
Yep.
But the melody is so gorgeous while it bounces along. Whereas But I'm Different Now is, it's really Dr. Robert, if you notice the riff slowed down. But, you know. But again, it's a love song, whereas, you know, a song like Start is about communication. You know, it doesn't matter if we never meet again. What we have said will always remain. If we get through for 2 minutes only, it will be a start. For knowing that someone in this life loves with a passion called hate. And, of course, the tagline, which is my life's philosophy, and what you give is what you get.
Yeah, right. You
know, all this built around Taxman, you know?
Yeah.
That's what makes this song, I mean, it is, I'm getting in that emotional froth because it is my favorite song by The Jam. It's my second favorite song of all time, right after The Beatles, naturally, Paperback Writer. 1966, big surprise, no. But Start was Paul Weller's, it was his masterstroke of not being a social diarist so much as being a person who could bridge the gap, you know?
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of the other tracks and give them their fair due. You know, you've got a song like Pretty Green, which just rocks, but it's a song about greed and money and the lack thereof, because this was at a time when people were becoming unemployed in the droves back then in England. You know, but it has a great feel to it. It was actually tapped to be the first single. He went to Polydor with two different, you know, 45 sleeves. Most people heard the two songs and said, you go with Start. And that was the right choice because it hit number one. Dreamtime, which you know, you read the lyrics. I mean, the song itself as he's singing goes by quickly, but when you read those words, they're amazing. They're amazing poetic couplets. You know, streets I ran in this old town, back streets and all I wanted to leave there. Scared I was, sweating now, my bowels turned to water. I mean, it's a song about alienation that is so eloquent. It's near impossible to approximate it to anything else.
Yeah.
Or a song like Man in the Corner Shop. You know, you've got the man who runs his business. You know, you've got the guy who runs the factory. And come Sunday mornings, they sit in church and pray together. For God created all men equal.
It's got a depth to it that wasn't there with a lot of the earlier stuff. It's got an emotion to it that wasn't there with a lot of the earlier stuff. And it just, I mean, for a fully fleshed out feel musically that, as you said, is kind of pared back from the in-your-face nature of what the jam was built on. But it did so completely effectively without losing the soul of it. And getting back to what you give is what you get, lyrically, that's just a more concise way of saying, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Or it's also a variation on the golden rule.
Right.
You know? Do unto others.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It all comes from the same place.
What I find so fascinating about this album is it was written by a 22-year-old. I mean, it's remarkable when you think about it, the depth and the intellect and the skill that went into this. And you know, the performances are magnificent. And yes, That's Entertainment is a great song. But, you know, even more powerfully is the – I don't know if it's really a call to arms or a call to be beware. A lyric like Set the House Ablaze, you know, it's a song about encroaching – It fits right now, especially with the whole left versus right mentality. Encroaching sides of violence that are drawn by political dictators that you find yourself falling prey to, or stupid or malleable enough to fall under.
Right.
I mean, that was a visionary album. And when I heard it, you know, you have those holy shit moments. That was one of those moments where I just couldn't speak when I first heard it. Mm-hmm. When I first heard Start, it freaked me out so wonderfully that the first thing I did was just go right out to find the album. And it was actually the first copy I bought, first two copies I bought. I've bought several copies over the decades. But the first two copies I wound up buying had, because at that time, of course, labels were very kind in doing this, they had the single of Going Underground with it, the
physical single, right,
to the cover. Because, of course, Going Underground entered the charts at number one in England, but wasn't released over here, naturally. So, you know, this is also the first time, oddly enough, that American Polydor got the album right. They didn't take any tracks off, but rather they did move Start from the number four position in the running order on side one and made it the opening song, which makes all the sense in the world. They also took what was the inner sleeve picture, this wonderful shot of them in soft focus by a lakeside, and made it the back cover, which I think was perfect for making it the back cover. Mm-hmm. Because the British cover was just a white cover with a small photo of them on the back, which I just thought was kind of weak. But I loved the front cover artwork because it's a pastiche of the old BBC sound effects albums. And I just think Weller's attention to detail in this particular instance, he had one of those very rare moments where everything was right.
Yeah.
But the album affected me so greatly. I would say that I became evangelical about that album and the jam in particular, and that would be an understatement. Psychotic would probably be more apt. You know,
you could be forgiven.
Obsessive, absolutely. That album was what made me want to be Paul Weller. I mean, there's, you know, no one who doesn't know me doesn't know this fact. You know, it's like everybody knows this.
Yep.
That's why Sound Effects is such an important record to me. And, you know, since we've been doing this wonderful segment, why not plump for the album that, next to Revolver, I hold in the highest esteem of any?
Well, right. And yeah, I mean, you just used the unintentional pun yourself when you said the album affected you, because, of course, there was the cleverness right down to the title of the album, Sound Effects, right, with an A rather than Effects with an E.
Proactive versus reactive.
Right. So what does sound do? Sound effects.
And thus, kids, if you're listening, go out. This is essential listening. Find this album, CD, cassette, whatever. Buy it. Play it. Buy it again. Keep a copy on hand at all times. This is sacred music.
And on the subject, yeah, it is indeed. And on the subject of buying it again, there's another one we're going to get to buy again. A little bit of an offering from Chris Bell from the folks at Omnivore, who once again have kicked it right in the butt.
Well, you know, that's the beautiful thing about the folks at Omnivore, because they're such music lovers and because they're such, I think it's fairly safe to say, big Star fans. This was a labor of love. But, I mean, they're doing this whole, I wouldn't call it a reissues program, so to speak, but a whole Chris Bell appreciation program would be a way of doing it. And because Rhino Handmade doesn't exist at this point, someone had to return I Am the Cosmos to the public. And who better than Omnivore? And they have taken I Am the Cosmos. They've taken the basis of Rhino Handmade's version, because that was the second edition of the album. The album finally came out in 1992 on Ryko Disc. Rhino Handmade added something like 10 songs that hadn't been heard with the original edition. And now there's another 9 or 10 more songs added yet again. So you've really got a truly deluxe edition, and it sounds spectacular. From Omnivore. And thankfully, because Omnivore is solid, this will be out and available for quite a while now. It won't be blink and you missed it or limited edition. You know, the beauty of I Am the Cosmos, because I'm not sure if we ever actually talked about this album.
No, not yet.
This is an album that never got to come out during Chris Bell's lifetime. You know, he never was able to achieve a record deal while he was alive. It was very frustrating and very hurtful to him. I'm sure most people who know the big star in Chris Bell's story know that it really broke his spirits. When Chris Stamey offered to put out the song I Am the Cosmos as a single, Back With You and Your Sister, it made Chris Bell very happy. It was done because Alex Chilton was the one who said to Chris Stamey, Chris Bell has the song, you've got to put it out. And that's how it happened, that simply.
Yeah.
But over the years, since Chris Bell had left Big Star, he'd been recording. A good portion of recordings had been done in the chateau in France that Elton John had recorded things like Goodbye Yellow Brick Road in, right? And he'd mixed it at Abbey Road with Jeff Emmerich, okay?
Yep.
So all these songs were sitting in a can, just waiting to be heard. So when it finally came out, cobbled together, thankfully, through his brother David and the good folks at Ryko Disc back in 92, you finally had what a Chris Bell album might have been. When you listen to it, it works. It works beautifully because the songs are so fully realized. These aren't half-assed demos and ideas and sketches. And we're talking in the context of the original album, the main album itself. You know, these were full performances. Performances that included people like Jody Stevens and Andy Hummel, Alex Chilton. You know, their Big Star is on there. You know, it wasn't done as Big Star, but they did the songs with him. Van Duren, you know, Richard Rosebrough, Ken Woodley, Bill Cunningham, you know, they're all there. Keith Sykes, all of these people are on these songs. You know, it's Alex Chilton's harmony on You and Your Sister. It's Bill Cunningham, who, if you don't know, is the bass player of the Box Tops, who did the string arrangements on You and Your Sister. You know, it's Jody Stevens playing drums on Getaway and a good portion of the other songs on the album, for that matter. The point being that Chris Bell didn't just try. he succeeded. All of these songs were done with a fine-tuned precision that you understand in the overall Big Star story why number one record was obviously that was the Chris Bell group. It wasn't the Alex Chilton group.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so fleshed out. And the songs that are on I Am the Cosmos, it's like the wonderful writer Rick Clark has said on many occasions, you know, when I first heard I Am the Cosmos, I went, that's where Big Star went. You know, everything that I had loved on number one record in Radio City went here, because you can hear the linear movement of what Chris Bell had brought to Big Star.
Very cool. So again, the deluxe edition out from the folks at Omnivore. You can get that now, and again, you should. So do that thing. And we've got one in the box for new music to talk about this week, and it's a man, and I hope I'm not murdering his name. I believe it's Seth Glier.
I think that would be right.
All right.
It's an interesting record. It's a little difficult to get through at times because the basis of it is loss. His brother had passed in his writing of this record, but his brother had been someone who had been, it's one of those scenarios where his brother had always been ill, you know, from the time he was a child.
Yeah.
You know? And so the way he was coping with trying to record this, as the story goes, he felt a lot of comfort talking to the birds that were outside the window of where he was recording this record, you know, and he would just literally just look out and to see if the birds were all around. So that's why the album is called Birds.
Right. Well, and you know, last week we were talking about a band who, or a guy who went back to his childhood home and recorded an album in a series of different places that meant something to him when he was a kid. This in much the same way. It wasn't just recorded somewhere there were birds outside. It was in a bedroom.
Right, right. And the thing is, it was, you know, it was conscious that he would do this in a very personal way. It wasn't meant to be a, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, but like a breakout record. This album is basically an open letter to his brother.
Used to feel it on the inside, a sweet sunshine every day. Could gather on the outside, still that sunshine remained soft against my window. I was whispering a change. I just need some sunshine today.
It's most poignant on a track like Hasn't Hit Me Yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's a visceral kind of intimate approach, but it's a very soulful slow jam with warm guitars. And it's when you listen to it, there is one really beautiful element in that he's talking about tragedy and hoping that there's something positive that will happen in the aftermath down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, so I completely applaud him for doing this. This is one of those albums that you have to consider a slow burn, because it's one that you need to think about. You can't just listen to it and go, oh, that's nice and that's neat, or, you know. It's ponderous because you need to think about what he's singing about. Once you know the mindset and the story behind it, you get it.
Right, and that's a difficult line. I mean, you know, as a songwriter yourself, that's an incredibly difficult line to walk without becoming maudlin. And I didn't get that from this. I didn't get that feel of, oh, yeah, I get it, let me up.
Right. It's his catharsis, but by his catharsis, he's able to share and give perspective to others.
Right. Share, not, you know, not bury right. you in.
Right. I mean, it's very helpful when a songwriter can do that, because that means he is putting the truly human touch into it. When to offer and when to draw back.
Yeah. Well, who hasn't been in that place before where somebody says, how you doing with this? And you say, it hadn't really hit me yet. I don't know. I mean, we've all done that. We've all probably said those very words, and to have somebody write it out and flesh out those feelings is a cool thing.
And the other cool thing is the fact that he's willing to put himself out there. I mean, that's highly personal.
Yep. Right.
So, you know, kudos to him for doing that.
Indeed. So, yeah, check this one out. It's called Birds, and it's out from Seth Gleer. More information on it in Rob Ross's review elsewhere on popdose.com. And a couple of other things before we get to In Our Heads. I know we talked a little bit of politics inside New York, but something happened this week that I think is absolutely fascinating, because as much as neither one of us has any time for Donald Trump at all, it's fun to watch the opposition party try to deal with him when he does shit that doesn't make any sense to them either. And what he did this week was he made a deal on the debt ceiling. And the deal that he made was with congressional Democrats. And they showed that great picture of Chuck Schumer standing there in the Oval Office, shaking hands with Donald Trump with his look on his face like, I'm not sure why this just happened, but we won, so I'm kind of okay with it. And the funny thing, what fascinates me about this story is that the Republicans really haven't trashed it, at least not with the vocality that they have before, but the Democrats really haven't gone out and waved the flag and done the we won happy dance either. It's like nobody's really sure what the fuck to do about any of this.
Well, hopefully that's a good sign. Because the immaturity that both sides have shown to this degree over anything,
yep,
in the last... how many months has it been since the election? You know, it's been just an atrocity, which is why I hate both with such an unbridled passion.
Yep.
The fact that they're keeping quiet right now and just, okay, getting on with the business, hopefully part of it is because right now there are bigger fish to fry and more things to worry about. Right before it, you had Houston. Now you have Florida.
Mm-hmm.
These are more important than the debt ceiling, because one just happened and the other one was about to happen.
Right.
Those are real human dramas and tragedies about to unfold. We just don't know how the Florida one is going to unfold. So by both sides keeping themselves calm and restrained, I think that's very good for the country.
Me too.
I think it's very good for – not for politics, because politics is always going to be the same filthy game. It's worse than pornography. At least you know with pornography there's a means to an end. But you know, politics is just as scummy as you can get. Plus, at the end of a porn shoot, you can take a shower.
Right.
In politics, you can't clean it off. And these people are amongst the most repugnant. I mean, I despise Nancy Pelosi. I despise Chuck Schumer. I sure as shit hate Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and Lil Marco and all those other dickheads. But the fact is, they actually managed to do something together, the two sides and Trump, and that is to just be.
Yeah.
Just remain. Keep quiet. Get it done. On to the next thing. And I'm sorry, I'm going to go out on a limb and say something that may get me killed. And at this point, I really don't care, because it's just getting so stupid every time. Because we've talked about this, that every time Donald Trump turns around, the press have to say something and jump on him and slaughter him and criticize him. And yes, we get it. But it's now overkill. You know, I thought it was actually a really good thing in the end, and very helpful to see him as quickly as he could get there in Houston on the ground. You can call it a photo op, call whatever, but, you know, dishing out food and handing out food boxes to people who had, you know, made it through Harvey in the shelters and so on, and talking to the people, actually talking to them and, you know, trying to understand what's going on. And I think he handled this far and away much, much better than the way that President Bush handled Katrina.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I hate to say this, but I think this was a very good moment for Donald Trump. I'm sorry to say, because there's nothing good about that kind of devastation, but the fact that the way that he handled and the way he's gone about getting people down there and getting people what they need, and Houston seems to have quickly drained out already, and is you know, it's a very resilient city, obviously. I just think that was also very good for the country. So that's kind of two wins for the orange prick, you know?
Right, right. But, you know, just to go back and show that petty nature, I think we may have even mentioned this last time around, is that people were bitching about Melania's shoes. Oh,
right. And the falsehood of that is the fact that she was in Washington. They didn't mention that. They played it off like she was in Houston wearing the fucking pumps.
But, you know, even if she had been, who gives a shit?
Right. There she was with him handing out food to these people. Right. They were doing what was needed to be done.
Yep.
And, you know, you and I kind of joked on it last week because he, in the typically illiterate Donald Trump way, he made it sound like, you know, it was something glorious. And I think I understand now what he was trying to say. He just doesn't have the ability to say it properly. When he made that comment about, you know, I think it was good for the country, I saw a lot of happiness, I think what he meant to say, if he was a literate human being and not a fucking remedial,
right,
he would have said, I think people were relieved. I think it helped for them to know that the president was there to try and help them. We're going to try and rebuild and get things back to normal as quickly as possible.
Right.
Now, and I think that's what he could have said, but he's a fucking Nimrod.
Right, and that's the thing, is that even the people who hate his guts and can't stand to say anything nice about him can revel in the fact that he'll fuck up again soon, so it's okay. You won't have to wait long.
Right, but for the moment, we can actually breathe.
There you go.
Just for the fact that we didn't have to deal with another of, what the fuck did he do now?
Right, another disaster. Exactly,
that
yeah.
Shock this week, John. We can't slam Trump this week. He's had two good things in a row.
Well, yeah, give it time. Like we said, next week, who knows? Maybe it'll all turn back around. But in the meantime, that brings us quite nicely to our In Our Head segment this week. And it's funny because I was considering a couple of different angles to go on with this. And it was something that we talked about last week, and you kind of mentioned in passing during the In Our Head segment that I wanted to dovetail off of. And this is what I decided on, because everybody has a song that they associate with a good time in life, a song that they associate with a person that they enjoy remembering, or maybe are still with, just a song that reminds them of love and good times and happiness and being with somebody of the opposite sex or the same sex or whatever the fuck you're into. But you know, it's like, I gotta give deference here. But at the same time, and I don't know, I've never been able to piece this together, whether I have had the worst luck in the entire world, or had back when I was still dating with girlfriends having shit taste in music, or if I just can't stand those bands because now I remember them and can't, I can't, you know, think that, how was I ever with this person? So whether it's a piece of music, like, I can't stand Bon Jovi. Cannot fucking, and I should. I mean, I graduated high school in 1987. I should love the guy, and I can't stand him, and I never could. And I'm pretty sure it's because of a girl I graduated high school with named Jackie. And if I never see her again, it'll be too soon. My ex-wife loves Def Leppard. Can't fucking stand him. Never could. So it's like I said, at least with the Def Leppard thing, I can say I never liked them much. So, you know, it wasn't her fault completely. But now every time I hear them, I cannot reach for the radio button fast enough because I just would rather not think about her anymore. So instead of telling me about the songs with the girls that you love or loved, tell me about the songs you can't listen to because of the girl you can't stand.
Wow. I mean, here's the funny part. Just right out of the chute, there's only one that I dated, but I couldn't stand the group before I met her.
Uh-huh.
So it already, that rot had already set in. Her being a complete imbecile, musically speaking, didn't help it. It just exacerbated things because I could see right through her trying to be hip, but she was being hip in that hip to be square kind of way.
Okay.
You know, oh, I really like alternative music. I like the Velvet Underground and I like Nirvana. Oh, that's all she had to say was Nirvana. I'm like, yeah, like you fucking know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Uh-huh.
But that's only the one instance because, quite frankly, I've never had a girlfriend who liked music that I despised. I always judged my women on their musical taste.
And what we've learned is I should have.
Okay, let's do this. My first long-term relationship was with a woman named Susan, who is no longer with us. We pretty much shared most of the same musical likes and dislikes, but for one. And this was the one big fatal flaw. She didn't like the Beatles.
Oh.
Yeah. Everything else she was good with, but she didn't like the Beatles. Okay, granted, not every single thing worked because she did not like Wire. Who else did she not like that rubbed me the wrong way? Those were the two that irked me the most, but the Beatles thing was just an impardonability. Liz, my wife of these 19 years, she and I pretty much from the get-go basically sat there and compared notes. In fact, in our first conversation, when she asked me what kind of music I liked, I said to her, you know what, it would be too long for me to go into. I said, why don't you just tell me some of the CDs that are in your collection and see if they're compatible with mine. And she said, well, in no particular order, Blondie. I was like, okay, well, they're a pretty good band. The Replacements, yeah, they were okay. R.E.M., yeah, I like them a lot. Husker Du, what? The Buzzcocks, what? And she started going through them, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to cut to the chase. Do you know Paul Weller? And she goes, are you kidding? The Jammer, like my second or third favorite band of all time. Like, the Beatles. I'm like, all right, here's the ultimate acid test question. Do you know who the Teardrop Explodes are? And in that voice that I would get to know so well, what do I sound like, an idiot? That's Julian Cope's old band. I was like, ladies and gentlemen, we have a winner.
Yeah, right. Did you start shopping for rings that?
Pretty close. I mean, we got married a month and a half later.
Attaboy.
That's not a joke. I got the question a week later, and she moved in 2 weeks after that. And, you know, we met on August 15th, 1998, and got married October 2nd, 1998. Yeah. So there you go.
Well, see, and not only did... go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we basically had the same taste. I mean, yeah, there's some diversity because, first of all, I'm 6 years older than her. So that's... There's going to be some difference, but, you know, there are some things that I like that she got turned on to, and there are a few things that she likes that I got turned on to. You know, she was more of a Foo Fighters fan than I was. You know, I liked the first record and then got sick of them pretty quickly, but later on I rediscovered my appreciation for the Dave Grohl, you know?
Yeah.
Because I can't stand Nirvana, but I really like Foo.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and totally different experiences. I get it.
You know, the girl that I loved in high school, this wonderful woman named Alice, she was, you know, your almost typical Staten Islander, and she was into the whole disco thing, but she was very open-minded. So because she was my best friend in high school, God, that's such a lame-brained phrase, but she was, a predictable, weird punk rock kid becomes best friend with the head cheerleader slash most popular and most beautiful girl in the school. Mm-hmm. I hipped her to bands like the Stranglers and the Buzzcocks and all that stuff, and she really got into it and to this day maintains a love of those bands. And I, you know, I introduced her to REM when I was introduced to REM. That's why when we went to graduation, like Murmur was our soundtrack because, you know, I got in and said, ooh, listen,
yeah.
I'm from REM. So it wasn't so much of the bands that I hated because of the shitty memories that go along with the relationships, because the one thing I will not allow is some form of music that I loved to, or even liked on a lesser level, to be sullied by someone who, you know, may have, you know, caused me undue pain and misery. All I will do is just, you know, wish for their imminent demise, and, or at least a life of misery for them. But, you know, the music belongs to me, because if that was the case, there was a woman I was involved with and she was an enormous Beatles fan. And there's no fucking way I'm relinquishing my love of the Beatles because I was involved with this twat. So,
yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is I should have known better, because with my ex, even though she did grow to like them a lot later on, the first few times through that I played her the Refreshments' first album, Fizzy Fuzzy Big and Buzzy, which I was as evangelical about as you were with the Jam album we talked about earlier, she hated it. And only later did she then come around. When I played the same stuff, all of Roger Klein's catalog for the love of my life and my wife, Jennifer, she loved them. Loved them right off the bat. And I should have known back then, and I kind of did, because Jen and I, when we were in our junior year in high school, both ended up at the same concert, unbeknownst to each other, because it was on the Monkees revival tour in 1986, and it was the Monkees, the Grassroots, Herman's Hermits and
Gary Puckett.
And Gary Puckett and the Union Gap. And we
same
both.
Same show. Yeah. Great Adventure.
Yeah. And it was.
I was the only one who knew all the words to going down and looking at these people like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know this? How do you know that? It's the fucking monkeys.
Right. Exactly. How do you not know this? Right. And the only thing that Jen and I disagree on a little is that she's way more into the Moody Blues than I am. But that's about it. You know, everything else has been just right down the line perfect. And it's weird shit, like you said. I mean, things that I wouldn't have expected her to know at all that I start playing. And she's like, oh, you know this too? Yep.
Well, it's funny because Liz has a definitive love of the same stuff that you and I love, the singles of the 70s.
Right.
You know, she will burst into, plus she can sing. You know, she will burst into any great song from the 70s. You know, there are some that she might look at me a little sheepishly go and say, yeah, I really like this. I'm like, well, what are you embarrassed by? I like the song too.
There you go. Yeah.
Or, you know, probably the person who is my closest friend and most trusted confidant, this woman whose name is also Jen, she, you know, she's a bit younger than me, but she was completely receptive to Big Star when I was explaining it to her. But it's like she says, she thinks she, because she's considerably younger than I am, she feels like she was born in the wrong era because she loves stuff like, you know, like Van Morrison when he was good and there was only one of him, you know, and things like Big Star and The Who and old Fleetwood Mac. You know, she likes rock of the 70s because this is what she grew up with.
Right. Well, know? I always felt the same way because I like my dad's stuff. So, you know, I grew up listening to that stuff in the car and grew a great love for it. So most of the music I listened to when I was a teenager was 20 years older than me.
Right. And then because you and I are of that age range, you know, growing up in the house that I did, that was just so musically healthy.
Yep.
You know, my parents had that incredible record collection. There are times that I really feel like a sense of guilt over not having taken those records, but there's no way I could live with those records physically. Yeah. I'd have to open a record store. It's that simple.
You're right. And at that time, by the way, my dad drove a bitchin' Camaro. So, you know, I had that going for me.
You know, we had all of Gary Puckett and the Union Gap albums.
Yeah.
You know, we had all Paul Revere and the Raiders plus Mark Lindsay solo records. We had, you know, the Grassroots, because you mentioned the Monkees thing. You know, I was the one who had the Monkees records.
Right.
You know, my mother had her Beatles albums. I had my Beatles albums. She had her Elvis albums. I had my Elvis albums. You know, there was a division. My mother, on the other hand, very frequently, and this is why I give her all the credit in the world, I would find my Minutemen albums not in my collection because she was listening to them because she found the Minutemen to be compelling and she really loved the herky-jerkiness of the sound, you know, the fact that they played songs that were under a minute, and she loved Boone's dry delivery. I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
She didn't like Husker Du because she didn't like Bob Mould's voice. She didn't like R.E.M. because she thought Michael Stipe's voice was way too funereal and disjointed. You know, and she didn't like the Smiths because she just thought Morrissey just whined a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, loved the guitars, couldn't stand the vocals. That's how attuned my mother was to things. But, you know, I'm very fortunate in that I can't qualify, you know, and equate stuff that I hate because of a chick.
The person you were with, yeah, when you heard it.
I'm talking about that because I dated a lot of dumbasses and, you know, didn't really get to the point of, and I'm sure they'll all say what a dick I was. Yeah, I mean, that's fine. It's a mutual, couldn't care less. But the thing is, you know, what's sacred to me musically may not be sacred to you. And it took me a long time to come to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, my musical snobbery, you know, had to get me off the high horse. Until it's moments when I have to get up into the bully pulpit and preach about, you know, the Jam or this particular REM record or, you know, why Big Star is the most important thing that will ever happen to you. If the twain never meets, c'est la vie. I like what I like what you like. I'll respect your taste. Yeah, I may not always agree with it, you know. I'm sure that if this was 20 years ago, if a woman I was dating or potentially dating said to me, do you like Huey Lewis in the News? I would say, I'm leaving.
Yeah, right. Only because you didn't want a chainsaw thrown at you.
No, because then I wouldn't want to take a chainsaw at her.
Right.
Remember, tries to cook and eat girl has habit trail. People, if you don't know the references we're making, read a fucking book once in a while.
There you go. Yeah.
Kill you. We might, but it won't.
Rob, we're gonna leave it sitting on the shelf from there. And too much fun as always. And this is what happens when we get in our heads. Thank you again, and we'll look forward to more of this talk next week, man.
Well, hopefully we will survive the second week of football. Congratulations to the Bills defeating the Jets in one of the most boring games I've ever watched.
Yeah, that was rough. I don't think it's going to be a terrific season for either of our teams.
No, thank God hockey's coming fast.
Yeah, but you know what? There was one thing. I mean, if the NFL wanted to give us a gift right off the bat, having Kansas City rise up and go into the into Foxborough and beat the shit out of the New England Patriots, that's good enough for me.
What was the final score? Because the last time I had looked at that game on Thursday night, it was, I think, 21-17.
Yeah, they blew them out. I think the final score in that ended up being 42-24, maybe?
Fuck, what the hell happened in the second half?
Oh, the Chiefs, while we're talking, and I've got, 42-27 was the final in that one.
That's awesome. That makes me happy because I hate the Patriots. I actually hate the Patriots more than I hate the Yankees.
Yeah.
I hate Bill Belichick. I hate Tom Brady. Even if Tom Brady wasn't the quarterback, I'd still hate the Patriots because I hate the fucking Patriots.
Right. You know,
there's nothing redeeming about them. They're the fucking Boston Patriots in those ugly red uniforms with the stupid white helmet and that ugly-looking bean-eating motherfucker on the sides.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, I haven't had any use for them since Steve Grogan retired.
All I have to say is, go New York Titans!
All right, man. Well, we'll talk to you next week, Rob.
Have a good one, brother.